Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, we've done a first for us together. We went on an aeroplane together.
Yes.
This weekend, we flew down to Newquay for our special retreat, which we're going to be talking about soon. And we flew back again. And when we flew back, we had a little one of your geography moments, didn't we, Lorraine?
Well, I think we had more than one, but I think one of them was particularly funny, wasn't it? I mean, I don't know. It's Cornwall to London. I don't know what it goes past.
No, you don't. You didn't know where we were. It was a very clear day. We flew along the South English coast up, you know, along Devon, along Dorset. And then you suddenly said, "Oh, is that Guernsey?"
Well, it could have been the Isle of Mull for all I know, Trish.
Yeah, exactly. It was the Isle of Wight, 4 miles off the coast of the UK mainland. Do you know how far Guernsey and Jersey are?
No, Trish, miss. No, miss, I don't.
No clue. They're south, 85 miles Jersey, 70 miles Guernsey. So, yes, that did make me laugh, though. You did make me laugh with your geography blooper in the air. It's very good.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
And I'm Trish Halpin. If you're living in a hormonal hot house, feeling a bit overwhelmed and in need of some positive, uplifting and comforting guidance on how to lead a more magnificent midlife, then this is the show for you.
We chat to celebrities and experts on all things midlife, from menopause and perimenopause to parenting teens, via fashion, beauty, wellness, nutrition, fitness, careers, relationships, caring for elderly relatives and your finances.
Yes, we ask experts and famous guests all the questions you need answered to have a happier, healthier and more harmonious second act. What a weekend, Lorraine. We're both feeling rested, rejuvenated, re-energized and basically full of all the feel-good endorphins. I think you can only get those particular ones from spending time in the company of a lovely group of women. Very special.
I think you're right, Trish. And we did find a very lovely group of women because we've just got back from our very first, our inaugural Postcards from Midlife retreat at the Samaritz Hotel near Polseth in Cornwall, Trebetherick. My home turf, isn't it? And what have we been up to? My goodness, we've done all sorts. We packed a lot in those 3 days, I have to say.
Gosh. Yes, we did. We did. We kicked off with a sound bath, didn't we, with Angela Conway, who's actually an NHS angel, isn't she? In fact, she's now doing a second career, sound bath things. We did that.
Yeah, she's a sound therapist and she works in safeguarding in the NHS. She just is such a lovely woman. And then everyone was up for the 8 a.m. cold water dip in the pool. I honestly didn't think we would see every single member of the retreat, but they were all there. What did you do, Trish? You did a little Wim Hofaniness.
I did my Wim Hof warm-up exercises that I learned on that that cold dipping thing that I did, which I talked about on the podcast. So we all did that, made everybody laugh. You got them all in the pool. It was freezing cold. It was lovely. It was lovely.
We all felt better afterwards. And then we gave them breakfast, didn't we? Warmed them up on the inside. And then we talked to our retreat guests about all the people that we have interviewed on the podcast and what we had learnt from them, both celebrities and experts, and what we learned from our own midlife. So we've interviewed over 200 people on this podcast, so there is a lot of learnings. And then we had a little breather, didn't we?
Yes.
And lovely local chef Emily Scott, you might see her on Saturday Kitchen quite a bit actually, but she was the first female chef to cook for the world leaders at the G7 summit. Joe Biden signed her book, and she showed us how to make stock. I mean, who knew that you could peel something with a spoon? You can peel ginger with a spoon. That was a big learning for me. And then we had the lovely Jamie, who set up Clemo Books in Newquay, which she actually only set up in December and has been running on her own. She did some pop-up books and then she set up a bookshop. And then we got the ladies into the wild spa at St Moritz, didn't we? They had a sauna, a hot tub, an ice dip and lunch. They were in there drinking their Camel Valley champagne, weren't they?
I know. Fair play to them. That was really good. And then we had, we took them off to meet Naheed de Beljoen, who's a somatic movement educator and breathwork coach, which was a new experience for all of us, wasn't it?
And then we brought them back from the yoga studio where they did that, and we all went on what we called a friendship walk, didn't we, Trish, to my favourite beach in the world, Dama Bay, which is just by the church where I got married. And that was just the first 24 hours.
I know, that was it. That was day one.
That was day one and a little bit of the evening of the night before. But it was really lovely meeting everybody and learning everyone's story, wasn't it?
It was, exactly. And the women were just amazing. I mean, it was like the Facebook group had come to life, hadn't it? And anyone who's on the group will know how smart, interesting, kind, funny, supportive all our 13,000 members we have on there. And some of these women, they travelled from all over the place. We had one guest from America. She'd flown from Connecticut. Another lovely lady from Belfast. They came from Kent. They came from Cambridge. And what was really nice was some came as friends together, and quite a few of them were like friends who met up here because they don't live near each other anymore. So they used it as an opportunity to get together. We had a pair of sisters who'd never been away on their own together since childhood, which I just thought that was amazing. There's a lot of women came on their own as well, but they felt very comfortable with it.
Yeah, we brought all these people together, and I have to say it was kind of heartwarming seeing how they all got on. I just assumed on the first night when we were having dinner that they all knew each other. It felt like they'd all known each other for years. It was a lovely get-to-know-you dinner. We had a chat with everybody. And the one thing we noticed, didn't we, so everyone could introduce themselves and drop the barriers a little bit and get to know each other. We asked them to tell the room one surprising thing about themselves. Oh my goodness, that was really enlightening. There is not one midlife woman that doesn't have an amazing story to tell. I mean, every woman in that room had a story that made you and me go, oh my gosh, that's amazing. How inspirational. And they were funny and they were good at telling their stories, and there was no one who felt like they couldn't say it. I think they felt like they were in a safe space. So yeah. I really enjoyed that dinner, Trish. Yeah, I was blown away.
Yeah. Exactly. I think everyone felt very included and part of our midlife gang. And I was actually very impressed that they all got up on the Sunday morning for our cold dip, because relatively late night in the bar the night before.
Well, it was a good job, wasn't it? Because you'd left half your clothes in the bar, hadn't you, as it turns out?
I know, exactly. I had. Yes, my very, very nice scarf. Oh my God, I don't know. Anyway, that's another story. But yeah, it was good. It was very good. And after the cold dip on Sunday, we interviewed one of my new favourite people, somebody you already know, Lorraine, the writer Kathy Rensenbrink, who I've never met before, and I just loved her. And we're actually going to be sharing that interview with you shortly. So you're going to get to experience a little bit of what our guests did on this retreat as well. And Kathy is an acclaimed memoirist. She's an author and a writing tutor, and of course, a Cornwall resident. And of course, she's also the president, this is impressive, of the Budleigh Salterton Literary Festival. I mean, she took the reins on from Hilary Mantel last year. That is very impressive, isn't it? She's very witty and wise, and she shared some great advice about processing emotional pain and also about writing. So whether that's because you wanted to get started with journaling, writing short stories, or even if you want to be published, lots of advice coming up on that, isn't there? So a few highlights for you, Lorraine, from the retreat.
Well, the tell me one surprising thing was my favourite bit. It really was. There was a story about Princess Diana's feet. There were stories about going into retirement, coming out of retirement, taking big jobs. There were stories about grandchildren, teenagers, the grief of empty nest. There was chats about IVF, baby loss. And then there was a very funny story about two ladies who'd been on a previous retreat. One of them had booked the retreat and the other had gone along, not really wanting to go. And it was a detox retreat, and they'd had to perform their own colonic irrigations, hadn't they? So when she asked her to come on this retreat, she said, you know what, I don't know if I can, because I can't go through that again. But reassured, there was none of that, was there?
No.
And then on the second day, one of our ladies who was in the audience of the podcast recording, one of our guests, talked about our community and what we'd brought together. Mm. And that phrase, you know, your vibe brings your tribe, was so, so true, because she explained how what we've done, and we've never really thought of it like this, and it's kind of what we actually set out to do, though, and we seem to have achieved it. What we've done is brought like-minded women together who really wanted to support each other. They didn't want to be cured. They didn't want to, you know, they didn't want us to come in and sort everything out. What they wanted to do was learn from others and lift each other up. And it was such a heartfelt thank you. And that word gratitude came up again and again, didn't it? I mean, we all kept saying, I'm not woo-woo, but I am very grateful for what we have here, yeah, and for everything in my life now, because there's so many other things happening that are quite tricky. But these women were really grateful for big and small things every day, which I thought was lovely. Finally, the stock ritual. Emily's stock ritual was my third favourite thing, Trish.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know you could put stock in an ice cube tray and then defrost it. It's a revelation to me.
I know. It was beautiful, the food that she sort of demonstrated making, because she then made this amazing, I mean, obviously you can't go near it, shellfish allergy, but she did this beautiful prawn Thai noodle soupy thing, which I am definitely going to be making. It was absolutely delicious. So it was just lovely to sort of, yeah, hear some things and then also have some demonstrations and things, which I really liked. And I mean, to your point about the women who came in the group, I mean, so many shared experiences. And I think, you know, some of the women were older than us, some of them were younger than us, but we all felt so connected because we go through the same things, as you said. And I think what we want from life isn't that complicated, really, is it? And no. I think everybody sort of got that and shared that. And we all kind of want the same things. And, you know, we don't have hugely high expectations. We just want to, you know, enjoy our lives, give back, be creative in some ways, parent well, and just be good friends and good partners where we can, which I just love that. So I have to say, finally seeing, I mean, four and a half years you've been banging on about Cornwall. And I do take the Michael a little bit about that, don't I? But I have to say, I can finally see what all the fuss is about. We had a little hour off, didn't we? And you took me to some of your favourite little haunts. We skipped off to Polzeth Beach. We did a moonlight little swim, early evening swim in Damer Bay.
It wasn't a deliberate moonlight swim. Let's be totally honest about this. We mistimed it. We mistimed the tides. We didn't know it would get dark so quick. And we looked up and the moon was out and it was dark and we were in the sea.
Yes. And all I can say is I'm glad you had your mobile phone with the torch on it to get us home. Otherwise, we might still be out there somewhere on a path on the Cornish coast. Who knows? Doing the South Coast Bath.
This is when you're glad I'm an Instagram addict, isn't it? And I take my phone everywhere. Yeah,
yes.
We'd never have got home. We'd have been air sea rescued, wouldn't we? Saving lives at sea.
Yeah, exactly. And then I love the somatic movement breathing session with Naheed, because I've never done anything like it before. I've done quite a lot of things, you know, the sound baths, all of that, but I've never done this. And it's very much about soothing the nervous system. I'm going to sleep like a log, like a log after that. But we're going to be bringing a little bit more about that next week, because we feel that deserves a little bit of its separate chat on its own, because we think it could be really beneficial for all of our listeners, not just our retreat guests.
Yes, I enjoyed that as well. It's just little tiny movements, isn't it, that really had quite a big impact on us. We'd like to say a few thank yous, because we did provide, I feel, quite a luxurious goodie bag. So if you come
high
up
quality
with me and Trish, you get nice goodies. We had Cowshed goodies, which Samaritz worked with, had Pentire Gin and Begin. We're ambassadors of the midlife skincare brand and Begin. They had products for us as well. A lovely little magazine called Drift Magazine. Tina, who runs Cornish Lavender, provided her new yoga mat spray. She's a really lovely midlife lady, set up a business down there. We got some more Centrum to hand over some lighthouse fragrance candles, which were lovely, very fresh and uplifting. Penguin gave us some books, so everybody got some books. Apple cider vinegar, we couldn't let them go away without apple cider vinegar.
No.
We had Willie's apple cider vinegar, and lovely Claudia Bradbury, who makes beautiful, beautiful jewellery, put a £50 discount voucher in everyone's bag. So I was super proud to hand that over, and we actually had tote bags with our name on it, which is a first for us as well. That's our first ever, what do they call it, Trish? Merchandise. That's our first ever merchandise.
Yes, exactly. Nice big thing to carry all of those goodies. So if that has whetted your appetite, we are going to be doing another retreat in the autumn. So stand by for news of that. We'll bring you more details soon. I think we should just finish off, though, with a little bit of a last word from one of our midlife gang, Sandy, who sent us this lovely email pretty much, I think, as soon as she landed back at home. She said, "Thank you so much for an unforgettable weekend. It was superbly organised, from gift bags on arrival, the wonderful food in a stunning location, to the informative, enjoyable activities, all of which made it such a complete experience. To be totally honest, I was quite nervous about coming alone, not something I had done before. However, I should not have worried. What an amazing group of people. I am sure I have made some friends I hope to be in contact with for many years. And of course, it was so special to meet you two too." That's us, you, me, Lorraine.
Me, Trish. Special to meet me.
Of course it's you, yes. "I am home now, unpacked and having a relaxing bath with my wonderful candle from you, and I feel ready to tackle the world. Thank you for facilitating such a wonderful event. I feel renewed, connected and refreshed." How about that? How about that?
It's literally the point of us is connecting midlife women so they can share experiences and have an even better second spring or second act. And we're going to hear a bit more now from a wonderful midlife woman who's had quite a life and written some amazing books about it. And Trish and I recorded her in front of our guests, sat in front of the sea with the sun shining down on us, down in Cornwall, which again is a first for us. So I really hope you love listening to Cathy Rensenbrink, interviewed by me and Trish in Trebetherick, Cornwall.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It's day three of our very first Postcards from Midlife retreat. We've been resting, rejuvenating, re-energising here at the beautiful Samaritz Hotel with the most amazing group of women. You've been absolutely wonderful. And now it's time to meet our special guest who's going to help us inject even more of those three R's into our everyday lives. She is Cornwall resident Cathy Rensenbrink, who is an acclaimed memoirist, author and writing tutor. And it was her 2015 debut, The Last Act of Love, about the life and death of her 16-year-old brother, Matty, and the unimaginable decision that she and her parents had to make, which put her firmly on the literary map. The book became a Sunday Times bestseller. And since then, she has written five other books, including How to Feel Better and Write It All Down. Last year, Cathy, now 51, was named president of the prestigious Budleigh Salterton Literary Festival, taking on the reins from Dame Hilary Mantel, which perhaps makes up for the fact that despite being shortlisted for various prizes, the only thing Cathy has ever won is the Snaith and District Ladies Darts Championship when she was 17. But you're out of practice now, apparently, your website.
I don't want anyone to put me on the spot, so no darts.
Now, Cathy has whizzed up the A39 to join us today from her home in Falmouth, where she lives with her husband and their son, Matt, a teenage son, I think. She says, "I'm not a doctor, a therapist, a philosopher, a priest, or an expert on anything. I'm just a human being who has thought a lot about how to be alive in this world."
And now we're ready to find out more. So welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Kathy.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. It just is beautiful, isn't it?
It is.
Inside and out.
Yes, the sky is blue.
Wonderful views wherever I look, at you, at the sea, at these wonderful women. I'm very pleased to be here.
Now, we're really looking forward to getting some of your life advice, which you've written about, obviously, in your book, and your tips for writing and journaling, too. But let's start with this idea of backstory and your backstory, because you've said that all of our backstories are important and that we need to connect with them and accept them as part of who we are. How did that process happen for you?
Well, I suppose because the big thing of my life was the death of my brother, which was awful and took such a long time. And I tried to sort of get over that, which to a certain extent I did. And I learnt that skill, which is good but also dangerous, of being able to act a more palatable version of myself. And so that what's happening externally is quite different often from what's going on internally, which is a useful thing to be able to do. But I always felt to a certain extent quite fraudulent, and it got to the point where I didn't, people really close to me in my life just had no idea about that. I couldn't really talk about it because I would then lose control or fear that I would lose control. So it felt like it was a very separate thing. And the only way I could cope with it was by having it very boxed off and boxed away and as an unknowable thing. I'd always wanted to write books. I think I've wanted to write a book since I've known what one was. So I'd always been writing. And I kept trying to write novels about other things. I kept trying to write the sort of novels I liked, which were funny novels about people making a mess of their lives by usually having adultery, which are still some of my favourite novels. I kept trying to do that, but then my dead brother would sort of arrive in the pages and hijack it all. And eventually I thought, I've just got to write about this. The unprocessed nature of this is clogging me up as a person, as a writer, in every possible way. I didn't expect it to be a book. I was doing it solely with the purpose of getting it out of myself, of excavating it, of being able to put it in a drawer and then write the sort of thing I did want to write. And that all changed. But what I learned from doing it and being with other people and having readers and talking to them and then starting to teach writing was that our stories will all be different. What happened to my brother's quite rare. It's probably unlikely that anyone here has had that experience, but you'll have had other experiences and I won't know what they are. But what we have in common, the universal thing, is that most of us, by the time we reach any age, we have difficulty and we have pain and we've got things that we're trying to cope with. And I think there is something about working out what to do with that so that you can then go forward into the rest of your life. Not in a sort of a, I'm all fixed and everything's fine now way, but just being able to move onwards, I think.
Are you comfortable explaining what happened to Matty when he was 16?
Yeah, I certainly can, if you like. It's so because I wrote a book about it, and at the time I was talking about them. I mean, I've told people this thousands and thousands of times. The thing that I still struggle a bit with is actually, I don't mind people knowing, it's still saying it. I still find it hard to choke out the next couple of sentences, which I will do because I feel nice and safe. So when my brother was 16 and I was 17, he was knocked over on a road near our house. I was there quite soon afterwards. I went with him in the ambulance and he didn't die that night. They did brain surgery on him, but he never regained consciousness. And he was then alive for 8 years, but never conscious again. And then my parents and I went to the family court so that we could end his life. So I was 17. That was happening between when I was 17 and 25. And as I'm sure you can probably all imagine, as the empathetic women that you are, was just extremely dominant at that time. And then continued to sort of reverberate afterwards. I do feel now I have reconciled, accommodated is the way I feel about it now. And I have reached the point where I do feel genuinely grateful that I had a brother at all. And at one point I wasn't able to do that. People would say that thing of it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And I'd quite angrily think like, well, I don't think that's true. I'd rather not have had this pain. But genuinely now, I think it's fantastic that I had a brother. And a shame that I don't know.
And I think your book is so moving, and I think a lot of people will have taken a lot of comfort, and it's a kind of grief resource as well. It's kind of amazing. We're here at St Moritz today, which is sort of a little bit your manor, sort of nearish, isn't it? And we're resting, rejuvenating and re-energising. We've been cold dipping and walking and doing all these lovely things. How good are you at the old three R's? What are your thoughts around him? What's your guidance for women? I know you like a bit of sea swimming.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm quite naughty at it in that. And I think sometimes it's because I do feel I sort of lost you know, after what happened to my brother, I was kind of like drunk for about a decade. And then I was a sort of a, I was a person who'd not fulfilled any of my potential until my late 30s. And then kind of suddenly, and then writing my first book, and obviously the emotional freeingness of doing that, and then having a new career. And then sometimes I think I've sort of treadmilled myself a bit, feeling like I need to make up for lost time and need to do things. But again, I've reached a place now where I've chilled out and relaxed a bit more, or at least acknowledged the importance of doing them and rest. And actually removal of, I'm quite sort of people pleasery, so I'm always inclined to just do what people tell me or do what people ask me. It's quite difficult to learn to say no sometimes, which I've had to do. It's an interesting one because I genuinely really love talking to strangers. Like I said, it's just my favourite thing. And of course, I love meeting readers of my books. But actually, I also really like meeting strangers where there's no context to it. I like meeting people on trains and I like meeting people on planes and quite often chat to people in the sea, which is one of my favourite things. But I've learned as well that I actually do need to retreat and withdraw from people. So I have to be private, which is quite hard. I'm inclined to just carry on riding the wave of there's lots of interesting people to talk to. Yes. But then I'll crash off that. If I don't look after that sort of transition, that'll go wrong. So I'm getting better and I find it's really helpful for me to sort of use myself as a guinea pig. And then I quite like having, I kind of feel everybody's an accountability partner. So like teaching writing, I'm always saying to people, like, sometimes you just need to have a nap. Stop trying to force more work out of yourself. And then I think, I need to listen to this too.
I love a nap.
Now, one of the books we're here to talk about today, How to Feel Better. The Last Act of Love was obviously your memoir about what happened. And this book is the advice that has seen you through. So it's a practical, helpful advice about processing it. And I really, really liked the epigraph that you had from Ovid, at the beginning of the book, which was, be patient and tough. Someday all this pain will be useful to you. So you've mentioned already a little bit about how the pain has been useful to you, but also that pain creates chaos for people and for others. Mm-hmm. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
One of the things about writing my first book, which I kind of didn't anticipate, I learned a lot by writing it, but then I learned loads more by having it in the world. And I learned so much because people would read it and write to me about their experience of it. Not all writers like this, but I love it. I also had some great new therapy because someone who read my book said, I think you should have this specific type of trauma therapy, which is called EMDR. I said, all right then. And I did. And so that changed my life afterwards, you know. And actually, I can now see that first book that's written by someone that has post-traumatic stress disorder and doesn't know it, I think. People say, how did you write? How did you remember that? It's because that used to play on a loop in my head the whole time. And now it doesn't, you know. So this whole engagement with the way people responded to my first book, I felt it taught me so much more. I mean, it's sad, my first book, it's sad. And people would say, I'd really like to give your book to my sister and this horrible thing's just happened. Do you think I'll be able to? Because the book's also sad. I used to say, like, I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things, actually, when something terrible happens to you is you're almost more equipped to be able to cope with other people's really sad stuff in a funny sort of way, like you've got your own stuff. But it started me thinking about how I wanted to write something where there wasn't the sadness. There was just the helpful bit. So I didn't need the content of what had happened to my brother. I just needed that thing of, we've all suffered and it kind of doesn't matter why, which is really what I think now. I don't think, obviously, sometimes it's good for us to work out the individuals of our own situation, but actually I'm much more interested in like a universal acceptance of the fact that we have all suffered, are suffering. So what do we then do next? And what can we share about how we cope and how we survive? And that's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to do in this. And then there is something transformative, I guess, in, I always feel really good if I can be useful to other people. It's just a good, it's like a good setting for me. It's nothing to do with me being a good person. It's just that I feel good. Obviously, something happens body chemistry wise, where if I feel I'm being useful to people, I just start to feel good. And then I also feel good when I don't feel I'm masked up and living a lie. I just start to feel better. And then they do as well. And then we all just feel a bit better. So that's sort of what I was after. There's so much shame, I think, around pain. So you have this terrible pain and then you tend to do things that are unwise. Then you're sort of surrounded by empty bottles and broken glass or whatever your thing is. And then you feel worse. And it's kind of this whole horrible sort of cyclical thing. And I wanted to acknowledge that. And then I guess myself sort of step off it and then think about if we think of life as accumulating experience, because I think there is something about kind of the consumerist society, isn't it? We're told the whole time that everything will be okay if we just buy the right thing. Perfect happiness is just around the corner. We just need to buy the right stuff. But actually, it's a really modern idea. Really, if you think of life as accumulating experience, then how would we expect to not suffer? We know people die, don't we? Like, we kind of intellectually understand that people die. So why are we so outraged that it happens? You know, is that sort of thing. So I think like now of life as being a way in which I accumulate experience and think about it, and then that transforms it for me.
Oh, it is really lovely, the book How to Feel Better. It's you have been incredibly useful in it. There is an inspiring addendum in the book, and you ask other writers to share their tips to hold steady and feel better. Do you have any favourite specifics from that advice?
I love the inspiring addendum. Rob Delaney's, of course, is both very useful. And then there's a little joke at the end, which I won't spoil for anyone. But when he sent that to me, of course, I was very thrilled because I'm such a fan of his. And actually, he almost more than anyone, I think, writes in a way that feels he's able to use humour to cope with the pain of being alive. And he sent it to me and I was just reading it on my email and I was reading it thinking like, oh yes, that's good and useful. And oh yes, that's useful and helpful. And oh, aren't we quite the same? And I do that too. And then I got to the joke and I was sort of like, ah! So that's really good.
It's quite naughty.
It's quite naughty. Yes, it's quite naughty. And then he was very, I said like, I loved that so much. And I howled at the end. He said, I was worried you might be offended. But I said, no, it's brilliant. And of course we have to laugh, don't we? Laughter's such a big thing. So I love his. I love all of them. The last one is Max Porter, my friend Max Porter, who's a brilliant, brilliant writer and a really beautiful human being. And that one always makes me sob when I read it. But again, I think crying is good for us. So yeah. I put that one at the end so he'd have the last word. Kit Duval, Sarah Collins, incredibly sensible, inspiring women. But everyone, yours, Lorraine.
Me
is
too.
Very, very lovely. Philippa Perry's is great as well. She says, I don't think we should be trying to feel better. Sometimes you just have to be sad for a bit and expect things to go wrong and people to die. It gets very bracing.
Yes. Be ready for it.
And loads of practical. I love the alignment of the emotional and the psychological and even the spiritual in some cases, but with the practical. And I think that's so helpful. And the general acknowledgement that we all feel like this some of the time, including if you're famous and really successful at stuff, some of the time that you need to have protocols, strategies. There's a lot of getting off the internet when you need to. There's a lot of getting into nature, different hobbies that people do, cooking, being grounded. But, you know, there's a really wide range of things. And I find it makes me feel better to just read it.
Hence the title. Mm. Very good. Now, your friend, the author, Nina Stibbe, who we've also had on the podcast.
She's been on.
Very funny. You must have such fun times together. She has said, Kathy has an extraordinary gift for helping people tell their stories, which brings us to another of your books called Write It Down. And just before we talk about that, though, because you grew up as a voracious reader, but your dad couldn't read, could he? So do you want to tell us, you were sort of almost helped him to learn to read.
I did help him learn to read, yeah. So the first time my dad is a really, really, my lips starting to wobble already. I love my dad. I just love my dad. He's such a beautiful man. Such a gift to a woman to have a wonderful, kind and encouraging father, I think. He's the youngest of 9 children. He was born in Cork City. His early childhood was kind of like poor but happy. All his early memories about being in the pawn shop queue with his mother. And the chaos around drunken men fighting in the street, all that kind of stuff. And then his mother died and things went much worse for him. And he truanted from school because he was being teased at school for being dirty, so he just didn't go. Then he ran away when he was 15, joined the Merchant Navy, sailed into Falmouth, met my mother. She looked after him. They're still very, very much in love with each other. Obviously very nice, but hard to live up to when your parents are a great big love story. And then he managed to get, I don't know if it's still possible you can do this, but certainly at the time you could earn a lot of money, even if you couldn't read, by doing really difficult, dirty, dangerous things, often underground, which was what he did. And then the law changed and he had to be able to write shift reports, which he couldn't do. So he went to adult education classes. And then when he retired, he wanted to read for pleasure. Well, I don't think he even wanted to, because I think he thought he couldn't. I don't think he thought he could read. But what happened was I was working at Waterstones then, and I was looking after events. David Beckham came to do an event, and I thought my dad would just like to own a book signed by David Beckham. So I gave him a signed copy of David Beckham, and he read it. So he started off on sports biographies, and then he started reading other things. And now he reads really, really widely. again, not kind of, he wouldn't read sort of difficult and intentionally confusing literary fiction. But he reads really widely, and he was very proud. There was one year when he'd read a book that was on the book a long list. It was The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. Wonderful book. And he'd read it before the book a long list was announced, because I knew he'd like it and I gave it to him. I said, not many people have done that, Dad. So he felt very pleased with himself. And he says, you know, when he's on holiday, he reads, and he says people look at him because they don't expect. He's tattooed head to foot. Had them all done before he was 18 and met my mum and then stopped. He's not tattooed on his face, but like on the beach, he's got this dragon that goes from his hip to his, you know, not these big tattooed arms. He says, people don't expect to see a man with as many tattoos as I've got reading a book. But, you know, there he is doing it. So it's just, wow. It's blissful. He's lovely.
Well, it is a fantastic book. If anyone wants to ever write about their life, Write It Down is the guide. And I did rely quite heavily on it for my book.
Excellent, which is very good. So I'm glad to see that
it worked. It was really good on structure and what you pull out of people. So you say you actually hold writing workshops and writing retreats. And a lot of the times people are passing down stories, aren't they? That's why they want to write it down. What impact have you seen on people who have done that, who have written their stories down?
I think it's actually almost always good. And I think one of the things, often people want to write a book for publication and almost that desire kind of stops them because they think they've got to know what they're doing and have a really strong idea. Yeah. And then they get bogged down a bit in, am I allowed and is there any point? And I think it's a great shame because for other things, like we don't think that if we went on a flower arranging course, we've got to immediately make money at it, do we? Or if we went to do watercolours, we'd got to be in the Tate Museum by next week. You know, like, but there's something about writing and other, and it's just in the culture. So other people aren't helpful. So you might say to your, it's often mother-in-laws, you might say to your mother-in-law, like, oh, I thought I might go on this writing retreat. And then the mother-in-law says, and I know this because I've been told this story hundreds of times. The mother-in-law says, like, what are you doing that for? It's very difficult getting published. You won't be able to do it. And then, of course, standing in your own kitchen, you've admitted your little heart's desire and then you've been quenched. I love working with people that have got a big ambition for themselves. And I have now. I've worked with lots of people that have been published. But whatever you want, the best thing to do is start off just thinking about writing as an ally for yourself. It gives you a private space where you can work things out on the page. If you're at all drawn to it, if you're not drawn to it, to be honest, I don't make people do it. If you'd rather cook a dal or go play football, then do that. You know, I'm never trying to make people who don't want to do it, do it. But those of you that have got that sort of secret, I could probably tell by looking at your eyes. Those of you that have got that. Oh, look. I don't know if you can tell, the air is starting to crackle between us. My hair's standing up on end. I found one of my people. So those of you that have got that little flicker, that little flame, and you've probably quenched it. And maybe there was a teacher at school who said, well, you can't write because you can't even do this. Or maybe you've got you as well. Maybe you got told off for having like crappy handwriting, you know, all those sorts of things. Today is the first day of your rest of your life when it comes to writing. You just need some paper and you just need a pencil and you just need to start doing it. And don't get into any of the bigger questions. Just start flexing the muscles and using words and doing it for yourself. And that's where you want to start. And writing down the world and keeping a journal and keeping a diary. And all those bigger things of what's this for and where is this leading to and how soon can I make money? And I'm going to read this long article about how it's very difficult to get published. And anyway, AI is going to take over the world and it's all awful and blah, 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 blah. Don't do that. Just don't look at that stuff. It puts you off. Just the self, using words on the page, doing it with yourself. And the great thing about that is, that then would just always work for you because you will always have that. There's almost no cost. It's almost carbon neutral. It's one of the most amazingly responsible things you can do in that I think it does, if you're that way on, I think it actually does make you an easier human being to be with. I find when I'm doing it properly, I'm just a bit nicer to be around because I'm not in a mood. Because again, I've grumbled. I've grumbled into my journal. And then that means I'm not acting out so much in my own kitchen.
Now, the journaling, it does sound like a great thing to do, but we might just need a little few tips on where to start. And there's a fabulous video of you on YouTube giving some advice, but do you want to share some of those little tips for wake up in the morning and where do you start?
Yeah, so again, I think this is all about making sure that you do what works for you. So I will tell you some stuff, but you need to be running it all, not through the filter of, I have to do what she says, I can't do that, so therefore I can't do it. Run it all through the filter of, what would work for me? So you're finding your own thing. So I do quite like a bit of first thing. I find my brain's nice and clean first thing. basically, I need to do any writing, really, ideally, before I've looked at the internet or consumed news. And then it often is really important to start really, really small. So the bigger your ambition, the more likely it is that you won't get going. So it's much better to write like, there's a variety of things I do, and I do change it up all the time. I like variety. And although it'll probably be good for me to do the same thing again and again and again, I just get terribly bored. So I won't do it. But if I've ever gone off the wagon and stopped doing it, too busy, and then I soon start thinking, oh, I'm a bit I'm starting to feel a bit fizzy. Splintery. What shall I do?
Like Trish gets fizzy if she doesn't.
Yeah, that's it. Fizzy. Oh, I need to connect with my therapist. It's not that that's a bad thing to do. But also, I think I just need to start writing my diary again. And then I will just do three interesting things. Three things off the top of my head. Bullet points. You don't even need to do full sentences. Don't try and make it pretty. Don't have a notebook that's too beautiful. Unless you like to use something beautiful. And you can even have post-it notes around and just write down one interesting thing. And they do that and then stick it in a book or something. So you want to work out how to have the fewest barriers to entry that will stop you and then do that. You don't want to be trying to do brilliant writing. And you don't want to write it and then read it back and decide it's a bit shit. That's like the worst thing you can do. Sometimes people get in touch with me and they say,
Don't edit your diary,
people say, like, I did that thing you said and I did it for 2 weeks and then I read it over and it's just nonsense. And it's like, well, that's also probably not true, because one of the things I find from my journaling, I'm going to whisper this, I don't want whatever's inside me, I don't want, it actually is very useful for my writing. But we don't want me to get into that because I don't, that's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it purely as a sort of a therapeutic way of downloading my brain and making me more able to be a decent human being, or at least not an awful human being. But actually, it is really good for your writing, because something to, you limber up. When I look back at it after a while, so not straight away, and I've got no idea of this as I'm doing it, loads of it's moaning and grumbling, but within it as well, there are some amazing jokes, some brilliant observations, whole paragraphs that are perfection, and I could just like cut and paste them into other things. But again, I don't even want to kind of know that, because that's not what it's for. And I don't want to become self-conscious in my journal. Or I don't want to think it's useful. I'm not doing it useful. I'm not on my own productivity treadmill with it. I'm trying to keep it as a secret treat. The other thing that's really good about it then is when something annoying happens in your day, instead of thinking something along the lines of, you know, why do I have such an awful boss, or why is my child so ungrateful, or looking at someone and thinking, why did I ever think it was a good idea to go anywhere near you? You know, that sort of thing. We probably all have our variations of that. Instead of becoming insular and depressed about that, as maybe you don't do that, but I do that, you can just think, I can write this down later on. Yeah. So it's a very helpful steadying technique. Maybe one day this pain will be useful to me, you can think. And then you can just write it down. Again, don't try and tell the whole story of it. Don't try and do the context. Don't try to explain. You can just write down the line of dialogue that made you feel really outraged.
Now you, we've got you here from Falmouth, but you grew up in Yorkshire. You lived in London in your 20s, and then you moved to Cornwall to be near your parents. Young Trishy here, she's got this escape to the country dream. I've tried to talk her into what the country's like.
Escape from London.
How did that feel, coming to live in Cornwall, away from London and previous life? And what tips have you got for people to assimilate into the community?
I mean, I would think very carefully about doing it, to be honest. I wanted to be near my parents, and I'm glad that I did it for those reasons. I suspect that I'm probably an urban creature at heart. It's always difficult to say, because I never want to appear ungrateful. And I do love swimming in the sea, and it is nice being around nature and having a bit more space. But I think that it's one of those things where we think we want something because we think it's going to make us feel a particular way. And I do know loads of people that have uprooted their family and moved to some broken down house because they think that when they're renovating that house, they're going to feel better about themselves. But actually, they probably could have just worked out what it was that was making them feel so empty inside before they bought a property. You know, so it's that sort of thing. Not that I'm accusing you of that, Trish, but...
Kathy's very brave today.
And obviously, moving house, moving country, whatever, even leaving people, I think, to a certain extent, it's really important to work out, how is it that I think this is going to make me feel? Sometimes I think we think that the real world action is going to change the way we feel. And quite often it doesn't. Or that the change of it is quite short-lived. Yeah, so I'm really pleased to live near my parents. But actually, in some ways, I regret, in a way, moving myself away from the support structure that my son had with his friends and that I had with the mothers of those friends, because that's really difficult when you plant at a later age. And I feel the lack of that quite a lot. So when people say, will you come back to London? And my son said that to me the other day. I said, you know what? I said, when everyone's either grown up or dead, I might. And then when I say that to people and they say, but where are you going to go swimming? But apparently there are, I never got Lido's. Into swimming in London, Lido's. But there are, yeah, Lido's.
Okay. I'm rethinking everything. but listen, let's talk about books again. Books you're writing, books, Budleigh Saunton. Budleigh's. Oh, why have I written Staunton?
I don't
know.
Well, you can't go to the country if you can't even say the name.
No. I mean, how exciting. I mean, the festival. Can you tell us what's coming up this year? Because it happens. What month does it happen?
So it's in the autumn, in September. Okay. And so Budleigh Saunton, which I have the honour to be the president, is towards the end of September. And then I'm the patron of Jersey Festival. And then that's just after that. So I'll be almost like running between the two. And of course, they're both beautiful. Actually, they're both coastal as well. Mm-hmm. So we haven't got a full programme yet, but I'm hoping that in both places, I'll do some sort of event where jumping in the sea afterwards is a possibility for those people who want to. No pressure if you don't. did a lovely event last year at Jersey Lido. Mm-hmm. I went in the sea last year at Budleigh Saunton, and the beach is really fascinating. There's huge, gorgeous, big rocks. So walking on it is just an entirely different experience than walking on any of, you know, the beaches where I live. And then at Budleigh Saunton's wonderful because there's lots of different venues, including churches. I really like doing events in churches.
You do get some really big authors come from all around the world, don't they, for this festival?
Yeah, it's amazing. And they've just had a little spring event where they had Clive Myrie and they had Salman Armitage did this fantastic schools event. So it'll be really brilliant. And I do a president's event. That's nice, isn't it, to be able to do that? So I have a little list of people I'd like to do over the next couple of decades, I hope. And I've written them all down. And then every year I'm going to write to them. And then the first person that says yes, says yes. Yeah. So I started with my friend Satnam Sangera, who also has a piece in How to Feel Better. What he does to feel better is he goes back to Wolverhampton, which I think is quite sweet. That's where he's from. So I started with him. And then I'm about to email someone brilliant. I better not say who. It puts them under a bit of pressure, isn't it? Forever afterwards, people that listen to the podcast say like, oh, didn't you go to Budleigh Saunton then? I don't want them to have to feel like, well, no, because my sister was getting married that weekend. Yes, that sort of thing. So that'll be wonderful. And then they'll have lots of brilliant people. And it's a really beautiful thing. There's like a really lovely tent and everybody chats to each other.
Amazing.
It's just delightful. Yeah.
It's where we met.
It is where we met, in one of the churches. Yes. Yeah.
We can't let you go without you telling us about your next book. And there is a big Cornish connection because it's about Agatha Christie. And mm-hmm. she learnt to surf in Cornwall. If you've ever read about Agatha Christie, she learnt to surf here. She was a big women surfer in her knitted swimming costume.
Agatha
Christie Cornwall connection is really strong. So tell us a bit about this book. I'm really excited for it because I love Agatha Christie.
So that's the next thing I'm going to do. So at the moment, I'm embarking on that book, which is really, it's just phenomenally excited. I've been obsessed with Agatha Christie since I was 9. For ages now, one of my coping strategies, along with the swimming and the trying to make dial and all that sort of stuff, is I just reread books in order so that I don't have to even make a decision. I can just jump from book to book. And I do it with Ellis Peters' Brother Cabfile Chronicles because there's 20 and they're really short. And I'm a really fast reader and I've read them before. So again, that usually gets me through. And I've been really wanting to do it with Agatha Christie, but there's over 70. It feels like a big endeavour. And recently I thought, I've been sort of waiting for something so terrible to happen. For something so awful to happen that I've got like 70 books worth of recovery time that I need to fill. And I had this revelation lying on the sofa, feeling really miserable at Christmas. I don't need to wait for something awful to happen. I could just do it. So that's what I'm going to do. And it feels very exciting. And I already have a publisher and I've not been published in America before. So an American publisher for it as well. So that's really exciting. I'm writing that now and that'll come out in the autumn of 26.
But is that a novel?
That'll be a book about Agatha Christie. Right. And then, but I do have a novel that's coming out in July that's also set in Cornwall called Ordinary Time. And that's about a vicar's wife. And Ordinary Time is the period of the church calendar where there are no big feasts. So if you know church, and you don't need to enjoy my novel, it's between Pentecost and Advent. And the novel's set there in 2019. I think of it as a historical novel set in 2019. Because it feels like a very long way away, doesn't it? And it's about a vicar's wife who doesn't quite understand how she ended up where she is, how she became a vicar's wife in the first place, why she keeps having to move house when her husband gets restless and decides he doesn't like the place where they live, how she answers the questions that her son, Sam, who's 10, keeps asking her, and then a handsome man hoves into view. And
well, you mentioned adultery at the beginning of this talk, so we've got high hopes.
I think it's the book that I always wanted to write. I have finally written a funny novel about adultery. Hooray! My sixth book. I've done the book I always wanted to write.
Well, thank you so much, Kathy. We have time for a couple of questions. Come on, Kat.
Hi again, Kathy.
Hello.
I was just interested, you were saying about with the Agatha Christie reading the books, it took you a while to come up with, I can do this now. But once you've decided to do it, does that put you off a bit? I like the ideas of things, but then when I've kind of committed and said I'm going to do it, I go off it a bit.
That is such a brilliant question. I feel we're utter complete soulmates and that our brains... Again, this is a real, like, my diamond shoes are too tight moment. Having managed to get my wonderful publishers on both sides of the Atlantic for my Agatha Christie project and all my dreams have come true, I do realise that one of my tasks is to make sure I don't make it into work. My main thing for it is I want to do it with this sort of skivy energy rather than a this is now my job energy. So that is literally what I'm going to do. I'm going to carry on doing other things like they are my bread and butter things during the day. And I'm going to do my Agatha reading and thinking in the dark hours. And that's my plan. I didn't think it could be a book. My agent just said, how was Christmas? And I said, oh, awful, because I hate Christmas. But anyway, I had quite a fun time reading Agatha Christie and I started writing about it like by accident, just because I can't not write books, even though I'm supposed to be on holiday. And my son was laughing at me and I said, I've accidentally started writing a new book, scribbling it into my diary because I wasn't allowed to turn my computer on. And my agent said, I think that could be a book, you know? It's so funny when you have, it's an extraordinary privilege to be able to make your hobby into your job. But actually, as soon as someone's paying you to do anything, it is also work. And so then one of my things is, because I'm really good at turning my hobby into my job, but then never have any hobbies. And I had this therapist years ago who was a very brilliant woman, and she said, you need to get a hobby. Don't get anything that you'll be so good at you can start getting paid for it. But actually, so far, any hobby I've got, really, usually then people say, why don't you write about that? But I resist, actually. I don't really write much about swimming, partly because I want to keep it as... leisure territory. Then I say I don't, but then I'm always talking about it when I'm teaching writing. I can't stop. So fascinating, isn't it, swimming?
who else would like to ask Kathy a question? Anyone?
I'm Caroline.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
It's not really a question, actually. I would just like to say you've been really inspirational listening to you. Mm-hmm. You've been absolutely fascinating. And what you said about writing, I've done a bit of journaling and I stop, start, and it's all a bit rubbish. Mm. You said it's not rubbish, so... it's good now.
Absolutely.
But also, I did a creative writing course a little while ago and I absolutely loved it. But it was also really brilliant what you said. I was thinking, why am I doing this for? Who's going to read it? You know, read it to my husband. It's like, yeah, that's good. And you just put it away. But I really, really loved it. So I think I might go back
doing
a course and thinking, actually, it doesn't have to be for making money or for a reason. Just do it because I love it.
Yeah, do it because you love it. And also just let it be rubbish. Like, who cares?
Yeah.
Don't even worry.
I wouldn't like it to be quite
I'm not
good.
Saying that to you. Like, you're obviously rubbish. But it's like, as I've just said, like, think about what I've just said about the Agatha Christie book. I'm going to try and write that in the spirit of it being a complete skive. I'm going to write that with the spirit of it doesn't even have to be good. That's what mentally I want to do that. Even though a bit of me knows that it kind of does have to be good. But it will be. That's the point. But at the point of writing, just let it be what it is and just enjoy it. I think that's fantastic. And I'm really, really, really delighted. On the whole thing of liking to be useful as well, whenever I go anywhere and I just feel, I can tell it because loads of you now have got little shiny eyes, which means you're all woken up to the idea of the pen.
Can I mention you, Sarah, or not? So Sarah's going to write a book, a novel.
Very exciting.
She already has some stuff. We were chatting last night. Do you have any questions? You've got one of the world's best writers here.
So my name is Sarah, and I've come from America. I flew in from New York a few days ago just for this retreat. Mm-hmm. It's been wonderful. So when I'm writing, I've started doing some short story contests. Mm-hmm. And it's great because they give you a prompt. It's a couple thousand words. It's nice to have that guidance. I feel like I don't know how to end it. That's some of the feedback that I've gotten. I think my writing is good, but mm-hmm. I feel like I kind of just drop it at the end, and I don't give it And so fiction writing, I don't give it a good conclusion. And mm-hmm. I think people, from some of the feedback I've gotten, is that it's disappointing mm-hmm. to people. So I'm just curious on thoughts on how to take a story and actually enliven it with some kind of interesting ending that people would care about.
This is great. Can I ask you another question first, though? Don't go. So tell me, and you're enjoying it. You would like writing the competitions and you don't find the feedback puts you off or anything.
I've only been doing it for a short time.
That's brilliant. Yeah. I wanted to check because sometimes people start doing competitions for the reasons Sarah said, which is they give you a prompt, it gives you a motivation, there's a bit of a sense of urgency. Often we need that for writing. But then if it ever happens that you're doing that and then like getting feedback puts you off, that often happens as well. So if that ever happens to you, you want to basically stop doing the competitions, reverse out of it, just go back to writing for yourself. But having worked that out, I'll tell you about a little bit about endings. So what we want to do when we write anything is, I think of it as this process of you sort of sprawl out for a bit. So again, don't just write, maybe you've got some subject, just like write loads of stuff, everything you can think about for that. But over the course of writing a work then, as you edit and edit and edit, you're narrowing down what your focus is and what you're saying. And a really good way to think about endings, I think, is that once you get to the end should like deliver on the promise of everything you've written so far. And I think the end should always be reflecting something that's happening in the beginning. So what you can do is look at your beginning where you start and then look at the end. And it can almost be quite good to, and if you look out for this in books, you'll see it quite a lot where, and actually in both my novels, I play around with where it starts and then where it ends, and that the ending is kind of often in a very similar location, but lots of things have changed along the way. It's a very light touch thing. One of the reasons why it's hard to learn about writing is when you only read published works, if the authors are good at what they're doing it quite invisibly. So, but really look about what the resonance is between your beginning and your end and where you've got to. But the way I want the reader to feel when they read the last page, I still want them to feel like, like that. So you have that sort of feeling of satisfaction. I've been on a journey. The author was in control of that journey somehow. I wasn't aware they were there. Didn't want to know what they thought about it either. I wanted to feel the characters were working. But I have a feeling of satisfaction. So I've gone on and on and on and on. It's because I'm enjoying myself so much.
Thank you. Well, that's a good ending on endings, isn't it? Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. And thank you for being so generously helpful.
What an utter pleasure. I've had the time of my life.
Thank you. Bum, bum, bum. Gosh, after all of that, we finally reached the end of the show. I hope you're all still listening because this should be good. We are at Nostalgia Noodle. Now, a little thing cropped up on our retreat because obviously Trish and I are very different and we approach life in different ways, which is why it works so well. But when I got out the list of people who were coming when we were meeting in the hotel foyer and a pen, little Trish's face lit up. She knew there was going to be some ticking off of names.
Yes.
So where are you noodling back to, Trish, connected to that?
Well, it took me back to, because we had to do a little roll call, didn't we, just to make sure we had everybody on the first day to take them up to the yoga studio. Just reminded me ticking off the register at school, when we were at school and they used to do the register. I loved it because I loved the neat book and the way that they did a line up the morning register and then a line down for the afternoon register. And it was in blue if you were in and it was in red if you were off. Sick. I mean, do you even remember that? I probably not even on your radar. I just loved the organisation, the preciseness of it.
Not for me, Trish, because my surname began with B.
Yes.
So I was either first or second. And then I would always in the morning, as you know, of a morning, I'm full of an enormous amount of energy, not so much now in midlife, but I would be full of an uncontrollable amount of energy every morning at school. And to have to sit through the register when you go to a comprehensive, there's upwards of 40 pupils in your class, to have to sit through the register all the way through without moving was quite a task for me. And often I'd be asked to sort of take my chattiness outside until the register was done.
Oh, no, really? That is so funny, isn't it? Because I just liked the order and I loved all the names being called out in order. And then you know what was a really special treat was if you got asked to take the register to the school secretary. I mean, that would make my day.
You would love that, wouldn't you? Pottering off.
You'd have ripped it up and gone home in a fit.
I'd have probably been sat outside the school secretary's office already for some misdemeanour of chattiness.
Yes, that's true, for another reason. So there we are. You have the lowdown on our lovely Postcards from Midlife retreat. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and I'm sure, like us, you will have learned some really amazing things from our guest, Cathy Rensenbrink. So do join us again next week and get in touch with us, as usual, on the Facebook group, on Instagram, or on our email, hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.